And I had spent so much time trying not to acknowledge all the feelings that I had and just trying to push forward on this identity that I felt was more important, that I had pushed myself to the limit where I was like fragile glass and I was breaking. And I had to look at the reflection of who I was and all those broken pieces and find something that resonated, find something that I could at least hold on to a little bit and build from.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts. Let me introduce you to Zaid Gale. Zaid was born in South Los Angeles. He was the son to social workers, a family that was instrumental in the early days of the Black Panther Party. Zaid's journey started out in the entertainment industry, making films, but now he's back building peace in Compton as a leading youth advocate. Zaid is co-founder and executive director of Peace for Kids, a nonprofit that provides a safe space for youth in foster care to build meaningful relationships with each other and adults. As a volunteer there, I've spent time alone with Zaid, listening to his story and sharing my own. I see why so many children look up to him. Zaid, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
Thank you.
So Zaid, maybe you can sort of give us some context for your story.
Well, you know, I'm an LA native, and one of the things that's been really important to me has been my spiritual grounding and being in a space of joy and happiness. You know, it's one of the things that I was taught, grew up at a church called Agape, and there was this energy that had been created there by my dad and my godfather, who were the founders of the church, that was all about being present and being mindful and being connected to your soul and your heart and doing that from a place of joy. And I had lived by those principles and found myself in a relationship with a woman who I met at my church, and she had helped me to start my nonprofit, which is called Peace for Kids, that serves youth in foster care. She was a teacher at the school where we started the program, and I was deeply in love with her. And we found ourselves in the midst of this life, and we were dealing with starting a family and having a home that we had bought and having the cars and the identity that you think that you want to have when you start a marriage. And we got together when I was 27 years old, and we were having a remarkable time, at least so I thought. And I woke up one day and she told me she was no longer interested in us being married. And at the same time, I was in a space where my organization, Peace for Kids, was beginning to struggle because the economy was beginning to take a sharp turn. And because we live off the generosity of others, with this big looming economic change that was happening in the country, those donations were starting to decrease. And I could see down the line that we were going to struggle with managing the organization and managing the staff and all those things, because we were going to run out of money. And here I was at, you know, 32 years old, wanting to start a life with this woman who I was committing my time to, and she no longer wanted to play. And it was hard for me to understand that from the perspective of what I'd been taught in my spiritual training, in my spiritual life.
Did you see any signs that this was breaking down and coming to this point?
No. And I take full responsibility for that. You get in a rhythm, and in that rhythm, you get to a routine. And I'll be honest, I wasn't someone who was really tapped into my emotional awareness, because, you know, you grow up in this spiritual world. And my interpretation of that was you suppress all those emotional energies that don't represent joy and happiness and prosperity and abundance and all those things that we think we want to have an experience of in our life. We don't talk a lot about the shadow side and the depths and the darkness. So I didn't really have any tools for dealing with that, because, you know, I was raised in this idea of wholeness and oneness, and that you're connected very deeply to God, and in that God was a loving God and you had to be in the love all the time. So I wasn't being aware, I'm sure there were signs along the way. And when I look back in retrospect, I could see them, right? I would spend all my time at work. I would come home and we would sit at the dinner table and she would have her dinner and I'd have mine. You know, we weren't in any way engaging with each other. And I just assumed like, that's marriage, right? You know, we're not always going to be connected and this is just a part of the rhythm and the flow. And that was my assumption. So there was no part of me in that moment when we were going through that that recognized the signs. I just didn't have the tools to pay attention. And as we were going through this process, you know, one of the other things that was really affecting me was that she wanted to have kids and we were unable to have kids. And I was told it was because of me. We had gone to a fertility doctor and the fertility doctor had said, listen, you know, I'm be really frank here. You need to know that you're in a situation where you don't have the motility in your sperm count to impregnate your wife. So you have an option. You can take Clomid, and Clomid, for folks who don't know, is this drug that, from what I had read, was the cause of many women who were going through fertility issues would have them have triplets and quadruplets, etc. And I, being a vegan, was like, I'm not putting that chemical in my body. And that put another strain on our relationship because my wife felt like, you're not willing to do this for us and our family. And I would say, why would I put my body at risk for us to have a child? If it does something to me long term, then I can't be around to support the family and have a relationship with my child and with you. So I don't feel comfortable doing it. So we had these things that were going on. So I was feeling really responsible about the condition of our relationship. And there was no part of me that recognized that I could do something different. I was unwilling to kind of make amends and take a risk and take the Clomid and go through any of the other things. And we were spending this money at the fertility clinic trying other, you know, modes of her getting pregnant. And all of those things were unsuccessful.
So you said you were taking a lot of responsibility for where the relationship was going. Thinking about sort of how it ended up unfolding, do you still feel that way?
Yes.
You see it as your fault.
I am a high integrity responsibility guy. I know that is my sword that I fall on. And so personal responsibility is one of my edicts on the planet. And I feel as though in any relationship, it is, of course, a two-way street. And I have a high degree of responsibility for what happens in that relationship. And because I am aware that I was not present, because I'm aware that I was doing things that put the relationship at risk and I wasn't willing to make sacrifices, that there is some level of ownership that solely falls on me. And there were many things that my wife was willing to do to help us move forward that just because of my principles, I was unwilling to do. And it had a residual effect. You know, I think the greatest impact on me was I fell into this deep depression where I couldn't sleep at night. I was having difficulty eating. I would have these recurring dreams. It reached a point where I was so worked up that I would just take maybe a 30-minute nap and that would be all the sleep I would get for a week. And then I had the other anxiety and stress of my organization kind of falling apart and developing a plan to let go of staff who I'd known for 10, 11, 12 years that were like family and figuring out how I'm going to let these people go. So there was this great level of stress that was just bearing down on me. And I had no idea how to get out of it. And I would find myself, we had this Yorkshire Terrier, you know, this little dog. And I'm 6'1 and, you know, like 215 pounds. And I'd be walking the dog through the neighborhood and I'd find myself just bawling, right? And one day I was just sitting on the curb with my little dog and I'm crying. And one of my neighbors drove by, was like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? In my mind, I just saw myself like this big 6'1 dude sitting down with a little puppy, you know, like petting him and crying. I was like, that probably looked like craziness happening right now. And I need help, right? I'm in a place where I'm completely stressed out And I don't know where to go with it, because in terms of the principles that I live with, I thought like I can meditate and I can pray and I can be mindful about what's going on. I can shift myself out of this pain. And I did not have those tools, not at all. And that meant that everything else in my life was falling apart, and I was allowing it to because I didn't know how to put it back together. The things that I've been taught to use weren't working, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And so that spiral just got deeper and deeper and deeper. And I went into this solid well of depression, where I was literally crying every day and unable to sleep. And so, you know, I had a friend who was a board member for Peace for Kids, and he seemed to notice that something was off with me. And he called me up one day and he's like, I think you need a break. And he was working with, he was a filmmaker. And so he was doing some work around this idea of earth medicines and how earth medicines can help to shift and transform the way that we think about issues in our life. And he decided to invite me to meet this Peruvian shaman and go out to the desert in Joshua Tree to have a conversation about whatever I needed to shift out of. And now, mind you, at this point, I'm so screwed up from not being able to sleep. And the recurring dream that I was having felt like its own sense of torture, because I was dreaming about a child. In the dream, I would be holding my son and I would wake up in a sweat. That's why I was only sleeping like 30 minutes, because I was like, every time I go to sleep, I'm having a dream about holding this kid, and I'm not having any babies. I can't have them, right? So what's going on? And so, you know, I go out to the desert, and I'm Joshua Tree in a tent with people I don't know. And this Peruvian shaman comes, and he's got all these folks who are helping us through this process, and they give us some ayahuasca. And I'm thinking to myself, what the fuck am I doing? I'm off of the desert with some people I rarely know, right? I've just had interactions with this guy who's been on my board for maybe 6 months, and I don't really even know this guy, but you know, he's kind of from my spiritual community. He knows that I'm kind of open to these things, and so he's brought me on this journey because he can tell I'm stressed out and I'm in this dark hole. And this guy who doesn't speak any English is talking, and I got other folks interpreting what he's saying, and now I'm taking a hallucinogenic and I'm going under. And you know, the Peruvian shaman talked about what I might see on my journey and how we get there and da da da. And you know, and next thing I know, I must be out. And it starts off with that same recurring dream. And I see myself holding this baby. And this time I'm able to stay with it and go through it a little bit further. And I begin having a conversation with my son and telling him I'm sorry that we're unable to have him come into our lives. And I feel this great level of responsibility, and it's why I'm sad, and it's why I'm broken. And my son tells me to stop. And he says, look, you're supposed to be a space for the masculine to come through. Your wife is supposed to be a space for the feminine. It was never going to work. You're not supposed to have children together. And the person who's supposed to be my mother is this woman, Tamika. And now Tamika was someone who I knew in the Peace for Kids community. She was a volunteer, but she and I weren't having this deep level of intimacy in any way. You know, we were friends, we'd been having conversations. But in this situation, my son was like, that's the mother. If you want to bring me onto the planet, you need to connect with her. And he went through to give me all these other insights about when he was coming, what his name was. So I had his birthday. I had, you know, this other sense about what his purpose was on the planet. And I come out of the visioning session, I'll call it, what other people might call it, a trip. And I'm fired up now, right? For the first time in like 4 months, I feel energized and alive and lighter. So I'm, you know, now I'm in the desert in this tent and it's dark and I've got all these people who are tripping around me and I'm like, I got to get out of here. You know, for the first time I feel good and I got to go. And so I go to the Peruvian shaman and through the interpreters, I say, I got to go. I know I'm supposed to stay in this tent with all these random people, but I got to leave. I got to call this lady and da da da. And he was hesitant about me going initially, but he looked at me and he saw, no, you're clear. You're okay. And he let me go. So it was like 2 o'clock in the morning and I call Tamika and I say, hey, I know it sounds weird, but I got to talk to you. I got to take you out. We got to have a conversation. She said, oh, okay, yeah, well, call me in the morning. We'll work it out. So next day I call her and I take her out to lunch and I sit her down and say, hey, I got something to say and, you know, you can tell me to screw off. It doesn't matter. And at this point, you have to realize because I'm charged, I don't give a fuck anymore, right? I'm like, if this is the one thing that's going to help me sleep, to bring me some peace of mind, to bring me out of this darkness, I'll do anything at this point. Because that's not really who I am. I'm a pragmatist, really thoughtful about everything that I do, take measured steps. This was far from any of that. I decided that because my sleep and my peace of mind is more important, I'm gonna make a crazy, crazy statement to this lady and try to convince her that she's supposed to be the mother of my child, right? So that's what I say. You know, I say, look, I know it's gonna sound crazy, but you're supposed to be the mother of my child. And she looked at me and said, you know, that's not so crazy. I knew there was something that was connecting us. And yeah, I'm willing to do that. And I said, look, I'm going through a divorce right now. I'm not mentally in a space to jump into another relationship. I'm dealing with all these other things in my life. So I can't make that commitment. I met our son. He told me he's supposed to come through. He told me that you're the mother of my child. And so I'm saying that, and you can still tell me to fuck off. And she said, no, I'm down. And a month later she was pregnant. And that was phenomenal to me because now I'm like, oh shit, I'm not even fucking divorced yet. Right. I'm no longer living in the house, but I'm in my own apartment. I just kind of started my own life. I had left everything to my wife, you know, she got the house and all these things. Like, I don't have any fucking money. What am I doing? You know, my business is about to close its doors. And I'm, you know, like, I'm literally taking money out of my pocket to pay for the staff that I have remaining to stay employed. Right. I'm like, this is crazy making. This shit does not make any sense. So I go to sleep after, you know, hearing from Tamika that she's pregnant, we're going to have a child. And I have another dream. And this time my son comes to me and he says, I know you're stressed out about the money. Don't worry. There's a gift coming because you were willing to open up your heart to the possibility of me coming in. There's a financial gift coming to you that is a gift from me. Okay. Whatever. So we get a call like a month later from a foundation, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a national foundation, has selected me to be one of their community health leaders. And so with that, the organization is going to get $100,000, and then they're giving me $25,000 just as a gift, an acknowledgement for the work that I'm doing. So I'm like, okay, all right. It gets a little breathing room. We got some money coming into the organization and I got a little money to help me during this transition period. So I'm feeling a little bit better.
So I wanted to step back a little bit and focus on the fact that you're running an organization called Peace for Kids and your social life is kind of out of whack and just all these things are happening. People on your board are starting to notice and so many children look up to you. And it seems like the problem in your relationship is this inability to have children, right? I think it's kind of like a really complex problem that happened in your life. And like, how would you rectify that situation? Like, how did you deal with that?
I think honestly, not well. So You know, when we think about what was happening to Peace for Kids at that time, I had to walk into a board meeting and tell them that I had failed. And I was used to always winning and figuring it out on my own. And because I was so depressed, you know, tears just came really natural to me during that time in my life. You know, it felt uncontrollable. And so here I am with all these kind of professional people, lawyers and, you know, corporate kind of CFO folks that, you know, look at me and like, okay, this guy's got it figured out, and I'm bawling, you know, and telling them like, I don't know what I'm doing. And they came up with some solves, and those solves were to go in and tell people that I love that I had to let them go. And I had never fired anybody before, let alone people that I really cared about. And so I called, you know, six of my staff in one by one and told them that I had failed, and that because of that, they were no longer employed with the organization. And so you know, in my life, I have all this sadness, and I'm failing in every aspect of who I believe I am as a human being, right? This community leader who's leading an organization that serves youth in foster care, these people who are my staff who are dependent on me to do my job well so that they can feed their families. And I'm telling them all that I failed and feeling highly responsible because I've had to tell the same thing to my wife, that I failed and I'm unable to create the family that we were committed to having. And none of that felt good. And so, you know, when I stepped into this.
And not to mention, you failed as a man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no mistake about it. Like a lot of our masculinity is tied to this idea of this bravado about being in the front and leading and starting a family and having the sense of accomplishment and pride. And this idea of me standing as this big figure, this looming figure in all of these areas of my life, and then looking at myself in the mirror and saying, you suck. None of these things that you think you are is who you are. And part of it for me was then to reflect, like, how did I get to this identity of self? And that question became something that was really present for me. And that was the question that broke me down. You know, it was the question that made me have so many sleepless nights, because I felt like I'd been lying to myself my whole life. I felt that, you know, the principles and teachings that I had gotten from my spiritual community, from my dad and my godfather, were wrong. And I had nothing else to pull from. And this was a representation of my failure as a human being to really embrace those principles, that there was really something wrong with me, that I had not gotten it, that even though I was raised in this community, there was something about me that was faulty. And so, you know, it all kind of came to a head in this moment where I was deep in this abyss, in a space where I've let go of all of my staff and dealing with my wife. I'm getting this divorce and I'm in this relationship with a new woman who's about to have my baby. And I have to go and tell my soon to be ex-wife that I couldn't have a baby with her, but guess what? I'm about to be a dad. And the reason why that happened was news began to travel fast in the community when Tamika got pregnant. So I was trying to keep it very insulated because I wasn't ready to share that information, but I had shared it with my dad and my mom and my sister. And within a week, I was getting calls from other people in the Agape spiritual community about me about to have a child. And my godfather, Reverend Michael, called me and said, hey, you know, you're a high integrity guy. You got to tell your wife that this is happening because she's going to find out soon and you want it to be from you.
Did that crush you?
Oh, I mean, it broke me in so many ways because I didn't know how to have that conversation. I was put in this position based on how I felt, right? That I made a decision that I couldn't have a baby with her, We had spent, you know, $15,000, $20,000 at this fertility clinic to try to have a child, and we had failed. And part of that failure was because I was unwilling to take Clomid. All this is in my mind, at least anyway. And so now I have to go tell this woman who, you know, I've been married to and committed to that, hey, I know we couldn't work this out, but I made a really quick pivot and now I'm about to have a baby. And I did not feel comfortable telling her about this experience that I had, you know, in the desert with these random folks to bring me to this awareness, because it still sounded crazy to me, you know, as open as I was to that opportunity because of how depressed and sad I was, I did not feel comfortable sharing that part with her. And so I had to go to my old house, sit my then current wife there. I mean, we were separated, but, you know, I had to sit her down and have that conversation. And again, it felt like I had failed. So I'm having all these areas in my life where I am a failure, right? And I have to embrace that, where in all other areas of my life, I've always been the winner. And I sit her down. I just blurt it out as quickly as I can. You know, she curses at me. She yells at me. She calls me every single name in the book that you can imagine. And she kicks me out and tells me she wants nothing to do with me ever again. And, you know, I walk out and realize as I'm sitting there, like, I'm a horrible human being. Like, what have I done? What have I done to this woman that I love? You know, this is the one thing that she said she's wanted from me, and I was unwilling to do it. And now I've started a whole new chapter with someone else before the divorce papers are even signed. And so I had a lot to deal with during that time, a lot that I had to reconcile. And so part of it for me was about recognizing that we are very complex as human beings. There's a lot of aspects to who we are, and that your darkness, these places that we're afraid to go to, can have a lot of light and have a lot of energy and transformation in them. And the more time we spend trying to defeat that shadow side without embracing it, the more fragile we become. And I had spent so much time trying not to acknowledge all the feelings that I had, and just trying to push forward on this identity that I felt was more important, that I had pushed myself to the limit where I was like fragile glass and I was breaking. And I had to look at the reflection of who I was and all those broken pieces and find something that resonated, find something that I could at least hold on to a little bit and build from.
Did you find it?
I did. It didn't come immediately. There were still some really difficult times to get through. I mean, I what I immediately went to was trying to control everything. And there was a moment where, you know, Tamika, I decided that, okay, I'm gonna move you into the apartment with me while she was pregnant. And she had this dog, and this dog that she had at her apartment, it peed all over the house. It was in charge. And I'm very particular about my space, right? I was one of the guys that was like, yo, all my colored shirts are in this drawer, all my hangers face this way, and those shirts are color coordinated. Like, I'm very, very structured. And so, you know, she said, I'm okay to move in, but I got to bring my dog. And I was like, well, if you bring your dog, I got to train that dog before it gets here so it doesn't pee in my apartment, because, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be here, but I'm definitely going to be getting my deposit back. And I'm not going to have this dog in here, you know, peeing everywhere and screwing up my opportunity to get a deposit. So, you know, that's going to happen. So I had got the dog on a very specific schedule, and I had told Tamika, you know, when I go to work, it's important that you keep that schedule, because I'm training this dog to make sure that it doesn't pee in the house, and you have to manage that. And so I went to work one day, and I came home, and the dog had like peed in the house. She hadn't cleaned it up, and I was hot. And I was like, okay, I'm done. You take your dog and you move out, go back to your place. You can't stay here anymore. And she left, and I found myself sitting in the house alone again and having all these reflections around, like, bro, you can't control the way that the world's going to operate. You've held on to that piece as though you can manage every circumstance in your life and make it right. And in doing that, all you're doing is pushing people away. And you have to open up to the possibility that life is a little disorganized and things are going to happen. And you're going to have to deal with that shit in a way that allows you to embrace the diversity of who human beings are. Is it important for you to have a great relationship with this woman so that you can have a great relationship with your son? Yeah. Well, then you're going to have to shift some behaviors. So I, you know, dealt with that for about a week. I'm feeling lonely and feeling sad and feeling afraid, and then was able to invite her back into the house. And, you know, I had to change some things. And she became my teacher in so many ways, because she's was not organized and structured in that way at all. Right. So, you know, laundry would be done and it would just go on the bed and it wasn't folded. It was like, these are now wrinkled clothes. I got to wash them, you know. So there were all these things that I had to just kind of begin to adjust to the messiness and the fragility of life and things that I could not control. And that actually became the thing that I held on to, right? I was able to pick up that piece, and initially it was control. And then it was about recognizing the fragility of life and how magical that is, right? That, you know, for all of us, anything can happen to us at any given moment that shifts the journey in a second. And if you can be present and mindful about that, then you stop worrying about what could happen and start enjoying what is happening. And that became the piece that I held on to, right? And it became the thing that saved me during that time.
Hmm. So when you're looking at that piece now, are you okay that it's not a perfect reflection anymore, just a small piece?
Yes and no, right? I struggle with it sometimes because it's in my nature to get back to controlling and managing things so I can get back to that very quickly. But now I pay attention to those moments when there's a shift and a reminder for me, like, bro, you ain't in control. You know, there are certain things that you can have a strategy and a plan for, but stay open to the fragility of the moment because that's where the magic is. And if I'm honest, that's where all the magical things in my life have happened. They've happened when I've been most fragile, because it's in those moments that the pivot takes me someplace that I could have never anticipated. And I want to encourage myself to be more present and mindful about that as a practice, because when you get to those transformational moments, you see yourself in a way that you didn't know you had the ability to exist on the planet. And in my mind, I always thought, like, well, it's about training, it's about discipline, it's about integrity and living your life in these ways. But for me, these transformations were happening because I did things I would never, ever, ever do. Never. You know, telling a woman that I barely knew that she's the mother of my child, never do that. Never. Right. Going to a place with, you know, a Peruvian shaman and trying earth medicine, never do that. Never. Right. I've never done drugs. I didn't drink. I didn't do any of that stuff. And so these were the moments that allowed me to step into something different, because I was in a place where I was willing to try anything to put myself back together, not recognizing that being broken was in itself a blessing. You know, being shattered, having your identity taken apart, gave you an opportunity to put yourself back together in a way I could not have done before.
A spiritual crisis. It seems like everything in your life had to break down, and that finally brought you to your knees around being fragile enough to open your eyes to a different spiritual path of sorts.
Yeah.
I wonder, how important is spirituality to you? Like, because you could have been down on your knees and forsaken everything. You sort of, you raised that point, actually, how you were mad at the Agape community and your godfather.
Yeah.
Because everything they told you wasn't true.
Right. Yeah. spirituality is very important to me at this point. I mean, I'm not going to lie. There have been other moments in my life where I didn't feel in control and I was pissed at God. Right. I kind of lost my faith in this idea that there was an energy and a force on the planet that was good if these things could happen. And I felt like I'm the good guy, right? I'm following the script. I'm doing the things that are right. I'm not Job. So why are you throwing these curses at me in the process of me doing what is supposed to be the right way to exist on the planet? And at the same time, you have to realize I'm working with kids who crisis has been thrown at them for no reason at all, other than they were given breath and life on the planet. And I had to reconcile the idea that there was a bit of, I like to call it, spiritual egoism. You know, we talk about spirituality in it and it not being about ego. And in the community, we talk about ego as edging God out, right? But there was this elitism to my spirituality that made me believe I was better and that these things shouldn't happen to me because I was anointed with this idea of the way that the world and the universe was working. And these young people that I were engaged with every week were dealing with crisis, were dealing with the fragility of life in every way. They were losing everything at 4, 5, 6, 7 years old and having to rebuild themselves. And I had this example in front of me all the time that I was unwilling to look at because it was more about me and what I was doing for them as opposed to them being the example for me. And that became something that in the process of my own spiritual awakening, I had to begin to look at. I had to recognize I wasn't serving these young people. These young people were serving me. They were teaching me about my own spiritual practice. And in that spiritual practice, connecting with another human being where they are is really what spirituality is about. It's about the oneness of the human condition. And that suffering is a part of that. We move through these moments in our life to remind us of our spiritual greatness, to remind us that even in the most fragile times, we can be made whole again. And there's nothing more spiritually defining than that. And that's why I said earlier that fragility is really important to me now, because I recognize, you know, that idea of, you know, what doesn't kill you will only help you grow. I begin to understand what that meant. And it's a kind of a spiritual way of being on the planet, which is to walk into the fire, recognizing that, you know, you're going to get burned. But when you emerge from it, what you'll see is a brand new horizon because the fire has cleared all the debris and brush from in front of you. So you can see something different.
Zaid, you said earlier that being broken is a blessing. Could you tell us what you mean by that?
I think when you're a kid, you know, the question that you often get asked is, what are you going to be when you grow up? And the problem with that question is you're asking a child who is experiencing the world and discovering all the diversity on the planet and how things operate together to make a decision about who they are. I think our spiritual purpose on the planet is to recognize that we are expansive beings that can be anything we want to be at any given time. And that the conditions that we set up for ourselves are the barriers to us embracing the possibilities of who we are meant to be. And we have all these constant reminders in the ethos of the media, in our daily lives and relationships with our family, in our relationship with our loved ones that are significant others. These things begin to shape and define us in a way that becomes our identity, and we become very rigid in that. And so breaking yourselves from that identity is what I believe is important. And that's a very fragile state of being, to wake up every day and say, how can I be different? How can I embrace a different side of me that is not based on the expectations of others, but based on my spiritual identity about what's important to me in this moment. And there's all this work now that's about mindfulness. And my mindfulness practice is about really trying to be connected with the fragility and being grateful for all the things that are coming my way that I did not anticipate. And that to me is where, you know, taking this idea of being broken and fragile leads to kind of the wholeness of the human condition and experience.
So one thing I'd love for you to do, you have this system called the haves.
Yes.
And hear, acknowledge, validate, shift.
Yes.
And I've gone through your training and it's amazing.
Thank you, sir.
I would love for you to do the haves on the younger you.
Hmm.
And, you know, before the mirror shattered. Hmm. And kind of put yourself through that.
Wow. So, Zaid, I hear that you really believe that being a black man of color and standing up for the social injustices on the planet is the role that you have to play. And that's a really powerful place to be. And I can understand that from coming from that journey that's deeply connected to who your mom was and is as an educator, who your father was and is as a minister, and their involvement in the Black Panther Party, that those are values that came to you from your relationships, from your ancestral heritage. The question that I pose to you is that really who you want to be? Or is that the expectations of who you think your parents want you to be? And I encourage you to sit with that. And you don't have to answer it today, but I want that question to sit with you for a while so you can begin to create the life that you desire. Because at this moment, I can see that you're really sad. I can see that you're struggling to find your path, but perhaps the path that you were on is not the path that you're supposed to be on. Are you willing to consider that as a possibility? And if you do, I'd be more than willing to sit with you on whatever journey you take to meet you at that crossroads to ask this question again, because I believe you have the tools and the skills to answer this on your own. And when you get to wherever you're going to go, you're probably going to have to ask that question again.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate your time, brother. It's been fun.